Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest joining me today, also coming from the fabulously fluoridated island chained nation, is Alexander Hales. And New Zealand's where he hails from, incidentally. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you today?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response, bro.
Somewhat fabulous indeed.
Yeah. Now, we met at the normal conference. It turns out you're also a bit of an up-and-coming comedian. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I studied drama school for 2 years down in Wellington, where I smoked a lot of pot, which is why I came to the conference. And, you know, I enjoy making people laugh, and I'm still not 100% sure whether it's my face or whether it's, like, actual talent. But that's where the up-and-coming is, I guess. So I've been kind of just dabbling in jokes and making family laugh since I was born. And then I just got up on stage and I forgot all my jokes the first night, and I just got really racist and people still laughed. So I guess it must have been something good, you know?
Well, you know, if you can get away with racism and have people laugh as opposed to call you a racist, that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, how I see it, if I'm openly racist about every single race, it's not racist. It's still being equal.
They all kind of cancel each other out, you know. It's like if you've got, I don't know, 20 diseases or something like that, you're actually perfectly healthy.
Yeah, oh, that's a bit of a strange fucking paradox, eh?
Well, you know, not as strange as the paradox that Monsanto created that was half ox and half parrot.
I was actually thinking, I reckon it'll be a really good campaigning idea for New Zealand this year, since it's the election year. They should bring back Facelift. Do you remember Facelift?
What was it, like some kind of a competition program with the policy?
It was like people got made up prosthetically to look like, you know, the caricatures and the papers of the politicians.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Just took the piss, like Don Brash would go to the clubs, try and sell ecstasy to find out about the drug laws and stuff and how it actually works. But he'd be like, yeah, I got a wife from Singapore. I'm Don Brash. And it was awful, but it was so funny. And Helen Clark was just an open lesbian with, who's the guy who looked like a pig? I cannot remember the life. I was really young when this came out, but I remember that's what got me into politics. It was so funny.
Well, in fact, I believe there was laws passed in New Zealand that made it kind of like illegal to take the piss out of the politicians, like against satire or something like that. I remember it being mentioned on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show in the States.
Oh, really? And they were probably laughing at that because, I mean, they take the piss out of their politician.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of the things, Parliament is sovereign, so they don't have to follow their own laws. And if they break their own laws, they can just change them. Retroactively.
Or fire one person who doesn't really have much to do with it.
Yeah. Isn't some piece of meat for the masses. Here you go. Here's a bad guy.
Where's a bad guy? Oh, yeah, true. So I was like, ooh, waiting for the bad guy. No bad guy, right?
Yeah, well, it's because they're kind of all bad. Well, I can't actually do that, like, carte blanche to say every politician in the New Zealand government is bad, right?
I can't remember their names, but the guys who came to the Colorado calling conferences were awesome. And I'm sure they've got a little bit of fucking, you know, underlining things going on there, but they were really interesting to listen to and really, like, you could kind of agree with their views on why pot wasn't legalized and that, like, as what they were talking about kind of thing. They weren't bad people. I honestly believe that it's mainly their leaders, probably.
Well, I think it's more like the reason I don't join organizations is because organizations tell you to do things, and because you're a member, you can't really not do those things that they tell you to do.
Yeah.
So regardless how good the politician is, they have parliamentary induction and they've got party policy that they're signed up to, and they really can't speak outside that paradigm if they want to stay in the party. And that's the thing that gets me, is even if they weren't corrupt, even if they were good, if the party is,
yeah,
then they're doing it by proxy.
So they can't really, yeah, which is kind of the downfall of our parliamentary system, though. I think, like, as much as it is a party of people coming together to kind of make a country better, in the end of the day, there'll be those certain couple of people that make the decisions. And you can't, like, no matter how much, like, someone disagrees with that, if they don't have a big backing, there won't be any change.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the reason why hierarchies exist, more or less, to keep the young and up-and-comers in the system for long enough so that they're no longer the young up-and-comers and they're simply the old continuation of what's always been before. Unless, of course, they get forced to change.
I noticed that through the when I went to the Dactory's fifth year anniversary with Blaze. And we went down there, and it was all these old guys, and I'm like, and me and Blaze having a chat, and we were just thinking, you know what, this has to be us. This has to be, like, my generation, and even Blaze's generation and your generation. It has to be us, because I don't want to say they're getting too old, because they're still doing, like, I mean, shit, there are some people from Normalhood still doing some huge things, but, and, like, really helping out, but they are getting too old. They need the fresh faces, the new generation coming through saying, yes, we still agree with this. It wasn't a one-time thing, you know? And
well, the way I look at it, I mean, I don't know how old most of your friends are, but most of my friends are, like, roughly twice my age. Mm. And what I think I've seemed to notice is that the reason I did that is because I didn't have my dad around for most of my life. And it came to a really important realization, is that my elders have been through a lot, and they've got a lot of knowledge, they've got a lot of experience, but they no longer have the energy of youth, and they no longer have, in many cases, the creativity of youth. Everybody comes up with their best ideas when they're young, and they live their life and so on and so forth. Experience and people telling you the opposite of what you think is true just kind of winds up killing that in some way. So I think the future is really all about the young generations getting together with the elders of movements and basically help each other. If you're young and you've got energy and ideas, it's up to the elders to help you to implement those ideas, how to develop them.
See, I'm the same. I never grew up with my father, and I've always had older people as sort of like role models all through my life, up to like into the 80s kind of thing, you know, like, and I am... I've always seen myself as much more mature than my age, so I don't really go out getting, like, absolutely trashed on the weekends like all my friends do. And I can see from the elders' perspective, like, I enjoy living in that experience, if you know what I mean, and living and kind of getting the knowledge that I need to move forward while I'm still young, but not having the arrogance of a teenager. And, yeah, so that's pretty much my philosophy on it all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also noticed that because I've acquired so much knowledge for free from my elders, I haven't actually earned any of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to earn the whole lot through walking through life and bumping into things, that sort of thing. And then I say, "Hey, Vinny, there's a cliff over there. You really don't want to look at. You really don't want to walk off that one. I did that once and I broke a leg. It was a bastard.
It was a fucking not fun time. Yeah, but how I see it is." Like, say, in the context of me going to drama school, after the third quarter of that first year, I had learned everything that I was going to learn from them. And all it was now is using that knowledge, that experience that they had, to further that knowledge and that experience to take it to somewhere else, to think of the new ways of getting around these things, you know?
Well, that's the ideas, youthful creativity and everything coming out, you know?
And how I see it is they've actually discovered recently, in the last week, I believe, that that memories are actually transferred down through DNA. And I found that really interesting because I love that page. I fucking love science. And it's on Facebook, I think. And honestly, they come up with like things that were discovered in this last month, and that was one of them, that DNA is now proven to be transferred down, and memories is transferred down through DNA. So you've got to really feel bad about the Aborigines because they've been saying that for years. Years and years.
Well, you're going to be feeling bad about everybody for that matter. I mean, you know, I'll just look back on my own life and think, frack. Imagine what kind of bad stuff I'm going to be passing on to my genetic heritage.
Oh, yeah. Those nights, eh? Those dumb teenage nights that we're going to have to deal with.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just now at the end of my 20s, and I've started to think a hell of a lot about my early 20s and my late teens and looking back and regret. And I've spoken to a lot of my elders about this, and they say, yeah, bro, it pretty much happens every decade.
Everyone goes to that stage where they just don't want to remember from about 15 to about 29.
Either that or you look back. What was the movie Watchmen? It says the future keeps getting darker and darker, but the past, even the grimy bits of it, just keep on getting brighter.
Mm. That's such a, I love the Watchmen though. They're such a good. It's like really morally, even though it's such a fucked up movie, you learn so much about because that's how I look at films. I look at life, what I can learn from the current situation I'm in, or from what I'm watching, or from what I'm reading. It's all a path of knowledge for me because when I was in high school, I really didn't enjoy learning because I was being forced to learn. But now that I've left school and I'm kind of doing my own thing, I kind of crave learning, if you know what I mean. It's quite a strange sensation.
Oh yeah, I think what happens is as soon as you get out of high school, you realize that oh my god, now I can actually learn from my own on my own volition, right? Like. I had to do homework on my own, but that was somebody forcing me to do something on my own. Now I can actually do something on my own that I actually want to do. And I realized that I just wanted to get wasted and party up and stuff like that because I wasn't allowed to do that while I was in high school learning.
Mm. I agree entirely. And then you kind of leave home or leave that environment you've been stuck in for fucking, 11, 12, 13 years. Of your life, which is the majority of your life has been spent in education. And I was thinking about the other day, I mean, I don't know how to fucking account my own information. And I'm a stand-up comedian, so I'm self-employed, and I don't know how to fucking do all that tax refund and shit. That's the sort of thing I think they should be teaching you in schools. You know, they're teaching you bullshit. Like, yeah, the first 10 years are probably all stuff you're going to need to know, but from there you can teach yourself that stuff, that English, that maths. You can all teach yourself that. But the things you're not learning in high school when you're about to step from a mothered environment into the adult world is all the fundamentals that you need to know to move on, you know, to actually get somewhere and be able to structure your life well so you're not fucking messing up all the time, you know?
Well, it's just what happens to prisoners after they get let out after like 20, 30 years inside or something. You get institutionalized. You become so dependent on people telling you what to do, telling you how to think, and telling you how to live your life that you, when you get let out, you get so depressed because your sense of identity was sourced from people doing that to you. And now you have to do that for yourself. You don't know who the hell you are anymore. And so that's why you wind up going to university or getting some kind of a crappy slave job or something like that, because you want that feeling to remain, that feeling like you belong to something.
See, I always have real heated arguments with my mum about money because I owe my mum a heap of money for just over the years, and I'm really intent on paying her back. But I honestly, since I've been growing up around this fucking corrupt, just I hate to use the word corrupt because it's like a terrorism word, you know? People are, ooh, corrupt. But I hate using the word corrupt, but it is such a corrupt system, and I get really annoyed that all it is, all money is debt, and I would rather be living in a society where we trade things, not money, because we're so dependent on money. If money disappeared, what would we do? It would take us so long to get back to a more simple time where you're just trading, you know, trading, and I reckon power can be free. I mean, they've proven that solar energy could fucking power the planet for years, you know, and it's so, it just makes me angry.
Oh, yeah. And there's a whole bunch of stupidity out there. And look at it this way. You've been born, you go into the institutions controlled by a bunch of scumbags, and then you come out believing that these bunch of scumbags are actually there to help you and make your life better, etc., etc. And it realized that later on down the track, well, everything was a lie, and you get really pissed off about it. You know, kind of like if you pay your $20 or something like that, and you get a box of beers for and there's supposed to be a dozen in there, 330 mils and 5%, and it finds out that there's only half a dozen in there, and they're only 2%, and they're like 150 mils or something. You know, you feel like you've been shortchanged, and you go up to the piss shop owner and you go, "Bro, you've sold me a lemon. What the hell are you doing here?" And the guy says, "Well, I've got a shotgun underneath this counter. Do you have a shotgun underneath your coat there?" No, I don't. "Do you have any offensive weapon with which to actually enforce justice upon me ripping you off?" Well, no, I don't. Then get the hell out of my store.
Pretty much. Like, this is what life is, eh? And since I learned that all money goes back to about, what is it, three families? Is it? I don't even know. I know the Rockefellers are one of them, and the Rotzenbergs or something.
Well, there was.
Sounds suspiciously Jewish to me, and I'm not.
It was Rothschild, I think. And if you go to the New Zealand Reserve Bank in Wellington, on the wall, the Rothschild in German means red shield, by the way. So on the wall behind the front desk of the Reserve Bank, the ground floor, you can even see it through the doorway. There's a giant red shield. And it has the crest of the Rothschild family on it.
Mm.
Yeah. Right, see, when people say this is, it's anti-Jewish or it's conspiratorial or something, dude, just freaking look!
It's there.
You know, what have you got to lose other than the entire faith in your system and the entire reason why you based your life and thinking you were free on it, you know? It's not that bad a thing to lose. I mean,
but if you ask a normal person, you ask them, is the Reserve Bank a government building, a government-owned thing? 90% will say yes. It's not. It's owned by the fucking families that own the money. And they can pretty much, like, I mean, money's just such a fuck system. All they're doing is printing it, and I don't know how much that costs or why it costs that much, but, I mean, to, like one $10 bill, I'm sure it must be fucking tons more, and it's just that's how the debt works. You know, they'll be like, "I need..."
Well, what they do is, it's, let's say they'll give you a dollar, but they'll also print another 6% or something like that. So it's a dollar and 6 cents for every dollar they print out, which means that there's a 6 cent reserve, which you cannot pay back because they don't actually print that money. It's kind of like a game of musical chairs. You put 10 chairs out and you have 11 people in the room. Eventually, when all the chairs are gone, there's only one person sitting down. Doesn't matter, bro. You got nothing. All right. It's a mathematically perfected system of ripping people off, which is why John Key was so good at it back in the day.
Because he, what was he? He was the smiling assassin, eh? He's still known as that.
I met a daughter of one of his colleagues at a party one night in Auckland, she asked me, "Vinny, do you know why they call him the smiling assassin?" "Not really." He says, "Well, my dad was working in the same office, and he came in and he fired 200 people on the floor. 200 people, one by one. They went into his office, got fired, walked out crying, you know, how am I going to support my kids and everything like that." You know, how guilty it would make an ordinary person to fire somebody, right? He's doing it all with a smile. And then after it's all done, he walks out of his office with a smile. The smiling assassin.
Because fucking that cunt, he has like $200 million, $500 million in the Reserve Bank in America or something. Like, in a fucking safe place that nothing can touch it. And he's just, all he's been doing is fucking working the stock market since he was like a 20 or some shit.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been like, I was unaware to it. He's actually been in the fucking media for years. But he was invisible to our country, really, until he became Prime Minister, you know, until he became the leader of National. And I just find it really weird that he just, what do we do now? I have all the money in the world I need. I've already fucked over countless businesses. I'm going to go home and just fuck with their system for like 5-6 years, as long as I can. Yeah. But that new book's come out on them, eh? I'm interested to read that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's going to be great, I think. Look, it's kind of like a... you've heard of Alice in Wonderland going down the rabbit hole. John Key's got a big rabbit hole, bro. Oh, my God.
He's been digging a grave for so long.
The things that he has done. I mean, just even when he was part of the National Party, I mean, what was his name? I interviewed Nicky Hager, and he was telling me about all these things that he was given by a National Party insider, all these private correspondence between the leaders of the National Party, and he said that the way that they referred to their voters would make every single voter never vote for them ever again. Okay, so if you're a National Party voter, supporter, listening to this now, they think that you are an idiot. They think that you are so easy to manipulate that they can tell you blatant lies straight to your face with zero evidence and that you'll believe them. They think that you are sheep and scum to be dominated, to be used as pawns to get their agenda through. Vote for them again. I dare you. And then argue with me about whether or not I was right. Tell me how many times you've voted these people in when they've done what they said they're going to do.
It's so suspicious that they illegalize something that is frowned upon in the community, or do something that is frowned upon in the community to make it better every election year. And that's it. What else do? They work for the rich for the rest of the time. National, anyway. I'm not putting up any fucking other, you know. And I found it really interesting, and I've got nothing against, like, Alistair or any of the ALC guys, because they're really nice guys and they've got some great fucking aspirations. Aspirations, but
it's like an aspiring aspiration.
Yeah, aspiration. Yeah, I can't wait to just appear and acknowledge.
I aspire to be an apparition. When I die, I'm never going away. I'm gonna haunt yous.
Ghost trips all over again. I saw that ad from then on. Aspiring apparition, man. No, anyway, fucking, I really enjoy. But what they were saying, what the Greens and the Labour guys were saying, were, look, if you're voting for ALC, as much as we may agree with their policies and things, it's still more two steps back, one step forward, because there's not all the votes going for ALC aren't going for Greens and aren't going for Labour to get fucking National out of the fucking house. But some people believe that how do we know that Labour isn't as corrupt, you know?
And I'm again, track record, bro. What has Labour always promised? And what has National always promised? And what have they both never delivered on? Anything that they've promised!
Anything they've promised. But anyway, I think that getting Labour through, how I see it, gives us more time to get Greens, because I'm a strong believer in Greens. I want to get their votes up. I need to see them get somewhere.
Oh, you need to know your Agenda 21 before you vote Green, bro. You know? You know about Agenda 21?
I actually don't.
No? Oh, dude, you got to freaking Google that stuff, man. Well, basically, UN Agenda 21 document signed by Jim Bolger, George H.W. Bush on Prince Charles' private yacht, 1992, Rio Earth Summit. It's basically a stock and stack total communist control system for a world government. Everything, every single thing that we do will be completely controlled. Most of the rural areas will be left back to grow back to nature, and people will be forced off their land into mega cities where they have smart meters, recording devices, hardly any private vehicle conveyance. It'll just be all public transport, totally surveilled. Chips and cards and everything have to show your identity everywhere, even when you go on the bus. Total control, dominance, and system. And guess who's got that as their environment policy?
Greens.
And Labour, and National, and the Internet Party.
What the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
How? What the fuck?
Exactly. It's because it's the UN. They're loving, they're caring, they're trying to do the right thing. It's called sustainable development. How could that be bad? Well, it sustains tyranny and develops it slowly. That's how it could be bad.
It's pretty much bad from the get-go. Don't say it's not bad and then not prove it's not bad. Just say it's bad and then stop doing it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Your problems, like, we understand you may be smoking a bit of crack on his yacht, but just fucking throw it away. Like, it's not a good It's not a good idea. I reckon that will be when I reckon there's a big uprising coming. Not soon, it's not in the near future, but it's coming, and people are getting more fucking upset about it. It's going to happen. It's just going to take over, and we'll start again. I really hope, or the Earth will end us before that before it comes to that. I'd rather fucking total genocide, or I don't want fucking. I'm not going to become someone's sheep for fucking their enjoyment, and just because they think it's right, they don't have the. I get so angry about that sort of thing. Sorry.
Oh, don't worry, bro. You won't be around to enjoy it. There's also an extermination program as well, and they've got concentration camps of a very modern design being popping up everywhere, according to a lot of crazy fringe reporters that never get any credence by the mainstream media. So it must be true. All right. Well, thank you very much, Alexander Hales, up and coming comic, coming to you. On the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. Also, check out our website, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. There's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, make a donation or start up a regular automatic payment today. It doesn't matter whatever you can spare, because I'm out there trying to expose scumbaggery and giving people the mainstream media often wouldn't let them share their ideas a wee bit of a platform or something like that. So if you just like that happening by proxy, then start up an automatic payment either through the PayPal with your credit card. You don't need a PayPal account. Or if you're a New Zealander, you can do the Kiwi Bank account there that is on the homepage. Also check out our sponsors, the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga, Blue Shield, the High Tea Cafe, and also something to plug in specifically here, and also the two books that we have on the homepage, The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes, a nice little novel for you, and also The Crowdfunding Revolution by Kevin Lawton. We'll be right back.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream, just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted, a fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go, in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the fabulously fluoridated Auckland capital of the island-chained slave nation of New Zealand. And it's just so fabulous that they've stopped testing for radiation on all the imports from Japan. That makes me feel like I could sleep at night, except when I have a Geiger counter next to me. My very special guest today is I just interviewed an up-and-coming comedian, and now we're actually... He's already up, comedian. His name's Gash. Welcome to the show, bro.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, backstory, the whole jazz. You got websites or nothing you want to plug?
I got my Triple O Gish fan page, which is actually my Gish page, but you find it by doing Triple O Gish, because my Double O Gish, it's a personal page, and everyone goes to that one, so I've got to try and flick them all over to the other page. That's a bit of a pain in the butt skis, but, it's what you do.
I don't know, we'll pop those links on the interview for you, she'll be right.
Choo-choo.
So how'd you get into this gig, bro?
How do I get into this gig? I started doing music school, and... in music school, they where we were learning songs, and then and I just decided I was gonna, wanted to put a bit of humour into my music, and so I did that, and I just started, I had a couple of songs up my sleeve, and then when I left music school, I kind of kept writing a little bit more. Well, my friends put me in front of like an originals venue, and I played a few of my songs, and they just told me I was in the wrong place, I should be doing comedy, and I was like, nah, I shouldn't be doing that. But I got straight onto pop comedy, and that's pretty much what kicked me off.
Boom. Just like that, eh?
Well, not just like that. It was a little bit more of a longer scheme than that, but...
Well, what is the longer scheme? I'm keen to hear.
Oh, mate, it's too long to go into that story. I've told that story so many times, it just kind of caves in my head.
Well, who cares about it then? I heard you were talking to a person from the Legalised Cannabis Party just recently, Alistair.
Yep. Yeah, he needs a little bit more stage time, I tell you. He is all right. Yeah, he wanted to get up and have a bit of a spiel on it. And funny boy, went outside and had a smoke first before he went on the stage, and he just completely nerved himself out.
Is that a bad idea in your experience?
No, not for me, but for him.
Well, especially if you're a first-timer, eh?
I wouldn't say he's a first-timer, but, yeah, he didn't really have what it took to get his point across to the crowd, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, have you got, like, a beliefs, political views, stuff like that, that the, I don't know, media aren't exactly supportive of yourself?
Can you ask that again?
Have you got any kind of views and political aspirations, etc., that the media might not exactly be too happy with?
Well, bound to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into them, though.
Yeah, because I don't know about you, but I've just kind of made a living off of going off and interviewing all these activists and everything. Interviewed Penny Bright the other day, the lady who did the private prosecution against John Banks and got him convicted for corruption.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, that's freaking great. Because corruption's my bag, baby. I don't like it, eh? Kind of like an Austin Powers sense of the word.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, moving on. I hear you're kind of getting around there, and I think you've played some big halls and stuff, haven't you, for the comedy festivals?
Oh, well, yeah.
Like, was that you with the two-string guitar and the shaggy hair and the New Zealand Comedy Festival, big theatre full of people?
No.
No?
No. I've never played a two-string guitar.
How many strings was it?
I've always had all the strings on my guitar.
Oh, nice. So it might have been my mistake.
Maybe even extra ones in some cases.
Oh, reels.
Yeah.
Okay,
I can play a 12-string guitar, so...
You can play a 12-string guitar?
Yeah.
I didn't even know they were...
A couple over here and a couple in Aussie.
Jeez, I didn't even know they existed, bro.
You didn't play... You need to get out more often, bro.
Sounds like it. Because, I mean, me and my mate, we've been playing music a little bit recently, and I'm just kind of amazed by the acoustic flamenco guitar at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that really fast finger picking stuff.
Whew. Yeah, yeah. Is that a bit of you? Is it?
Oh yeah. Well, it just seems like it takes a lot of skill and it's really really hard. So it's kind of one of those things that I'd never really attempt to do.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, chuck it in the two hard basket sort of thing. Other people have skills like that. I don't.
Yeah. That's right.
How long have you been playing the guitar?
I picked it up when I was 15.
Shoot, boy. How old are you now? If it's not a personal question.
I'm in my 40s.
Oh, okay.
Let's go 41, roundabout.
You know, you must be real good right now. How many hours a day you practice?
Hardly any.
Oh, yeah. I think that's about it when you're around with the mates and stuff.
Yeah, I got myself to a point where I was happy with my skills and I didn't really attempt it anymore because there's so many good guitarists around, they can actually put you off a bit.
Yeah. It's not so, like worth competing.
I've got my crack in the industry, so I just follow that, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, dude, you know, you've found your own style, which very few other people have actually got, and you've managed to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
Can't fault you.
Sure.
Who the hell could?
Oh, lots of people.
Well, bugger them.
Yeah, bugger them.
Yeah, at the end of the day. It's like, oh, you're not got a slave job and a slave, getting in the slave traffic. Oh, what an idiot. It's like, dude, yeah, I'm living my own life the way and expressing myself in the way I choose fit. And yep. I'm actually making a living off it and I'm surviving. And I don't have to do what other people tell me to do in a lot more ways than most people have. That freedom.
Yeah, but I've still got to listen to their shit.
Yeah. Do you?
I'm not allowed to say that word, am I?
Go for your life, mate. You can say whatever you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think
don't
this
keep my shit to myself, then.
Well, I don't know about you, but I really hate those kind of regulations where you can't actually say what you want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
A little bit too much of that. Ever since frickin' high school.
Hey?
Ever since frickin' high school, primary school, whatever. There's all these sort of things that we can't say.
Yeah.
Yeah. We say them all the time anyway, and we think them, so what's the difference?
I'm not too. Is this an interview or a conversation?
It's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B.
Ah, okay. Sure.
I've just been going for like 5 years. Basically, I bring a person on and they get to say whatever they want to say.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's just kind of like two people like meet at a cafe, have a coffee and have a convo. Just 3,000 people listening.
I don't meet people
listening.
At cafes. Have you seen my look?
is it like a... What would I hear somebody describe it as? It was like a Māori cousin it. Was that about right?
A what?
A Māori cousin it. Like, you ever seen the Addams Family?
A Māori cousin it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll run with that.
Totally fuzzy, totally Māori.
Yeah.
About right, I thought. So what's the problem with cafes then?
With cafes?
Yeah.
I don't know. You're going into a league out of my conversation, bro. Or a conversation out of my league, more like.
Well, take it back into something that's more your style, mate. You've got the platform.
Well, I was more thinking of if I could just answer some questions a little bit more rather than kind of delving into my own life and talking about crap that probably people don't want to hear.
Well, here's the thing. That's what every other interviewer does. Whereas what I want to hear is what all the other interviewers never get to hear.
Yeah, well, I'm not good at talking about myself, really.
But anti-narcissistic, eh?
Aye?
Bit of an anti-narcissistic bloke.
You're
not in love with yourself?
No, shit, no.
A lot of people like that in so many of the entertainment industries, I've found. Have you seen that kind of I'm so full of myself, totally dishonest swagger about people in the industry?
Yeah, totally. Well, I'm not going to name anyone.
Well, no, not name anybody, but let's think of it as a symptom. And it's not just really in that industry, it's in a whole lot of other industries. It's like these really dishonest, really nasty people who just steal other people's ideas and get their way up there. And what occurs to me now, and this is kind of what I want to ask you about, do you feel that happens in comedy more often than not, that some of the really great comedians get kind of like maybe shafted or ideas stolen or something of that nature, and they get really depressed about it, and they don't really go any further, like they almost drop out to a degree? And,
what, because they've had their stuff stolen?
Yeah.
Nah, it doesn't happen that way. If people are getting their stuff stolen, they go and see the person that's stealing their stuff and they have them out with it. Whereas I don't get my stuff stolen because, I do songs and stuff, and you got to be able to play the guitar reasonably well, for starters. And I've had one person from Aussie. He came over and he did, I do this Kevin set, and I have about five Kevin songs in amongst it, maybe even seven or eight that add to it. But he pulled out of the five, out of the Kevin songs that I did, he named every single one of them and just said, well, you know, what if you just changed the word Kevin to heaven you know, it was knocking on Kevin's door, and it was like, it was all the punchlines to all the songs that I'd done, and he did them all in order. And my now manager turned around and goes, "Do you recognise that?" And I was like, "Hell yes, I do," but he does it really badly. So that was only one case in my scenario where I've had, you know, something of mine that was attempted to be stolen, but he did such a bad job that it wasn't even worth hitting him up about it.
It was like his own worst enemy, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, the worst thing he could have done. Hey, there's a word somebody called me, and I think it also applies to you too. The word means can't be imitated. Inimitable.
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you feel that having an original style sort of makes it difficult to get across to audiences, or is your style just sort of like straight on through? It's totally original, and yet everybody gets it.
Yeah, pretty much that.
How long did it take you to really derive that? Were there people encouraging you or discouraging you from this course in your life?
As soon as I wrote my first couple of songs in school, people were like wanted me to play them straight away. So as soon as I was picking up other songs, and like people were quite happy to hear them for me. But it's the parodies that I actually tried to stay away with to start off with, because I always thought the parodies were too easy, and you know, they're cheesy and shit. But I thought that, you know, once I did one or two, they came really easy, and like they were getting a good laugh. So I thought, well, yeah, okay, they might be cheesy and bad depending on where you do them. But I was, the way I was managing to get them out, people were as where people would normally find musical comedy bad, out, you know, done out of bad taste or something. A lot of people were taking my stuff on rather than pushing it to the side. So that was kind of nice. The difference between good comedy and bad comedy, I suppose. And maybe just the way that the guitar is played in the background helps, I suppose, too. And maybe not singing out of tune.
Always
a combination of the lot, you know?
Yeah. It's a good combination of factors, like any good cake.
Sure.
And I was just thinking as well, in terms of that, are you familiar much with Bill Hicks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was just listening to his old recording, Arizona Bay, that he recorded back in the early 90s in England. And there was all this music in the background, all this guitar and songs that came in these intros and outros. And I watched a documentary later, and found out that it was him doing all that music.
Yeah.
And I never knew that.
No, I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah. Well, you see, I found comics. There's one person told me used to be a doctor subcontracting to the NSA. And he told me that the two most intelligent peoples, you know, groups of people, professions in terms of the like, are theoretical physicists and comedians, for the same reason that they're capable of taking complex equations and ideas, simplifying them to the point where they're comprehensible to people.
All right.
And I think that's what comedy has brought to our lives, is an ability to understand things a little bit deeper and be able to laugh about it and just deal with how crap things are sometimes.
Yeah, totally.
Have you ever changed anybody's life, like actually given them some sort of an awakening experience? They've come up to you and just go, "Oh, bro, that totally reminded me of this," and changed
my life. I'm sure I have, but like I haven't gone back to check with those people. See, you know, if it has made a difference. But yeah, I've had people come up to me and say it, whether it has or not is a different story.
Well, there might be some kind of a ripple effect.
Yeah, possibly. Hey, am I able to, do you have any questions for a friend of mine? Because I need to go to the toilet really badly.
Absolutely, go
but
for
I can't your... drag you to the toilet, would be so easy.
Go for your life, son.
I'm putting it on to my mate Colin, he's a skydiver down here in Queenstown, sure.
No kidding. Awesome.
Cheers, mate.
Yes, go, ladies mate. And gentlemen, the musical intro while we wait for Gish to take a wiki leak. And now we have the skydiving master, Colin. Welcome to the show.
G'day, mate. How are you?
I'm somewhat fabulous. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Day off down here. She's finally snowing on the mountains, so no skydiving for us today, but good for the skiers and snowboarders anyway.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, I'm in Auckland where it's sunny.
Oh, mate, I'd rather be where it's sunny, trust me.
Now, considering skydiving, that's kind of like an extreme thing, and I saw an article on Facebook the other day talking about the huge amount of deaths in the New Zealand tourism industry. Not necessarily saying that skydiving is one of them, but
yep.
We've actually got quite a dangerous environment for tourists in this country, and people don't realise.
Yeah, big differ. Being in the industry, seeing it from the other side, it's quite stringent and safe, to be honest. Obviously there is a high volume of tourists coming here, and New Zealand is seen, and particularly Queenstown is seen as the adventure capital of the world. So that we have like a concentrated group of people coming to this country specifically just to do these activities, and saving up the activities to do them all in New Zealand. So of course, per capita, we have obviously a lot more people exposing themselves to risks, because let's face it, any kind of adventure activity is risk involved, and that's why you do it, because you get adrenaline from risk and it's fun. So
I was curious as to whether or not they were including hiking and things of that nature in those statistics, because there's shockingly large amounts of people who go. There's new stories every year about people going missing on the mountains and never come down.
Yep. Yeah, I have no idea. I'm only familiar with the adventure sort of adrenaline related activities that I sort of participate in. But it's so safe. Like skydiving these days, it's not like back with the old round parachutes and stuff. It's so safe that you're at more risk on your way to the skydiving operation in the van or driving there, rather than when you're actually jumping out of the plane. That's the safest part of your journey.
And I found that incidents like this, they sort of do get blown out of proportion by the media. Like,
of course,
wasn't there some plane that crashed in a field before taking off last year or the year before?
Yeah, that was 3 years ago now. That was on the West Coast, Fox Glacier. But yeah, that's really the only sort of the major skydiving incident. Obviously unfortunate, but planes taking off, planes crash every day. Regardless of what they're being used for, it was just unfortunate that they were almost full of skydivers and the media jumped on it,
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like it's the exciting news
story
of the day. If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, the news is just always the stuff that, we're quite vicarious as humans, so they give us what we want to see on the news to capture your attention,
I completely agree. And I think there's the difficulty here is being able to watch the news anymore and actually take it seriously,
it's like grab all the shock sort of headlines and run, make a story out of nothing.
Well, see, I'm sick of waiting for the next big thing, frack that anxiety. I mean, that's why I don't watch the news anymore. I mean, because the anxiety will kill you faster than the events that are covered on the news ever could.
Oh, of course, you turn TV on at 6 o'clock and it's just, war, AIDS, salmon, death, depression, recession. You look outside and it's just sun shining and birds tweeting in the trees, mate. So that's Bill Hicks, by the way. I didn't make that up. But, you just live your own life, mate. You may as well go and have fun while you're here and not sit in front of the TV watching all the bad stuff that's happening in other parts of the world.
Yeah, well, I think it's like because we sit there in this constant state of, oh my God, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news. We're like constantly on edge. We've got our adrenaline going the whole time. You should save your adrenaline stores for things like skydiving, people.
Exactly, yeah. Turn the TV off and get outside, mate. It's my two cents, mate. I'll pass you back over to Gish.
Okay, all right.
Cheers. How's it going, mate?
It's going pretty sweet. You had quite a good conversation with old Colin there.
Yeah, I heard you got out a lot about his life.
Well, it's kind of what I do. I'm like the priest of talk radio. But it's a terrible world anyway. Now, speaking of which, in the realm of professional comedy, criticism. Have you noticed that you're almost above it when you're on stage. Like, if you talk in the political sphere about sex, race, ethnicity, or politics and things of that nature, you get chastised, you get one group or the other coming after you and tearing seven colours of crap out of you.
Yeah.
What about if you do it on stage? You just get people laughing.
Yeah, no, it's not always like that. I've had Māori guys, girls, nanas, grandfathers come up to me and tell me that I'm way out of my league with the comedy I'm doing, so I shouldn't be doing that because it's racist and shit. And it's like, well, it's nothing about the racism that I do it for. It's the stereotypical way that people look at me, and the way that I, you know, stereotypically just give it back to them. They have a laugh out of it, so I take it to stage, and then there's the people that get a little bit righteously conscious, and they get up and they have a big, you know, stir up a big fuss about it. I've had to stop my show plenty of times for a couple of people like that, you know.
Oversensitive?
Oh.
What do you think they've got a point?
But righteous about their, you know, their beliefs.
Well, I found it's when people get offended like that, it's an emotional reaction, and there ain't actually a whole lot of thinking involved.
No, it's just, too serious.
Why does somebody who's too serious go to a comedy show?
Oh, because, they think everything's going to be a joke. Everything's a joke, but, like, they don't, when you start hitting on things that are true to life, that you want to, you know, make a joke, that's when they get all fucking serious about it. And it's not
What, do you reckon they're taking it personally? Like, here you are...
They've probably been sitting at home with their grandfather and their grandmother or something going on about their land rights and stuff, and they've got it in their head that they've been missing out all their life, and then so you start taking the piss out of it, and then they'll jump up on their, you know... They will literally jump up and stand in the middle of the floor and go, "You guys are all blah, blah, blah," which I have had before. And I've had people stop, you know, just sit in the show and say, "Oh, nah, I've got to come up there and smack you over if you, you know, anything like that," and then they won't leave the bar, so I've had to just wait for them to leave, which they won't. That's, yeah.
Sweet mercy.
Yeah, no, there's some people out there that can't handle it, for sure.
What, you ever had bottles thrown at you or anything?
No, I haven't quite had a bottle thrown at me.
Whew. Thank God for that, son.
But I have, you know, there has been the odd nasty comment that has come back to the stage, like people have wanted to rip my throat out.
Well, as long as they don't, you know, you can keep singing songs that piss them off.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not the sort of person that likes to go around pissing people off, you know.
Yeah, I'm just making lemonade out of lemons here. You know. It could be worse. Gish, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you search him up on Facebook, it's O-O-O Gish. That's G-I-S-H, like a giant fish. It's Gish.
That's the one.
Mm-hmm. And if you check out his comedy, on, I think there might be some of his stuff on YouTube and stuff. It's pretty freaking funny. But as again, two best pieces of advice that I've ever been given in my life. By the editor of the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine, no less. Number one, don't take yourself too seriously. Number two, don't take what other people say about you personally.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and thank you, Gish. Gish,
cheers,
and we'll be right back.
Time to keep me waiting.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the fabulously fluoridated Auckland region. It's so nice with water scarce surfaces and all of that kind of jazz. Hey, they're now charging for wastewater back the other way, you know? So not only the water you drink, but also the water that goes down the sink, they charge you for. You've got to love that, Sheehan. My very special guest right now is, I believe, Wyeth Chalmers. Is that how it's pronounced?
Right. Oh, look, it's good to be here. It's good to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do, because we're doing a little bit of a Comedians of New Zealand sort of soiree here. And I'm not unfamiliar with your brand of comedy.
Okay, well, yeah, as you say, my name is Wyeth Chalmers. I've been doing comedy for about 6 years now. I made my name in the Wellington comedy scene. I've now moved down to Dunedin where I sort of run things. I run a comedy brand called Comic Addiction, and we put on shows here in the South. We've done a couple of tours recently. We're planning another one for August. I've been in two international comedy festivals. 2011, I was brought back as one of the best of the fest comedians, so all that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's who I am.
That's freaking awesome, bro. I have some want to be a comedian, mostly because part of my inspiration for becoming a talk radio douchebag behind a microphone was listening to really ranty kind of conspiracy theorists and Bill Hicks at the same time.
Yeah. I feel you.
Well, do you have sources of inspiration that you draw on or things that just keep you going? Because, I don't know, sometimes it's really hard to see the lighter side, for me at least.
I mean, I'm always watching comedy and listening to as many new comedians as I can. I probably don't find enough time for that as I'd like, because one has to make money and things like that as well. But comedy certainly is a great passion of mine, and I think my ideas for comedy just come from stupid people. And fortunately, we're in a country that are just full to the brim. and so I can really play on those idiots, yeah.
So literally, when you walk in any city or town in the country, you were literally waltzing through a gallery of comic inspiration.
Oh, yeah. That's just the thing. Like, it could be anything. One of my favourite things to do used to be, if I was really bored, I would see somebody walking through the streets, and I would just stop and think about them and analyse them and stuff and realise all the stupid stuff they might do. And there's a joke there. Or my brain is very fast. It works all the time. I never really switch off.
Well, I was thinking that's very similar to how I look at things. It's almost like you see the truth of things, and it's really dark. And and the dark is really is actually it kind of pisses me off. And so my brain works overtime trying to find find something funny about it, so I could just deal with this crap that I'm seeing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're desperately clinging and scratching the darkness to try and find some way to deal with it. Yeah, I agree with you, man.
I mean, the diamond in the rough.
The diamond in the rough, yeah, it's there. There's that pinhole of light. What's that going to be? You know, let's run towards it. Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me in terms of it's almost like there's a prestige in presenting the news, and there's almost like a lovability or laughability with comics. And to me, it's actually become reversed, that I get my news from the comics and I laugh at the news reporters.
Yeah, exactly right. That is the way the wheels are turning. Because we're always finding things out, like every time before I get up on stage, you know, I'll find out what's just happened. There's my opening material, you know. What's going on right now? That's what I'm talking about, you know. I'm always changing and updating my material all the time. I'm not talking about the old stuff. I'm here. I'm present, you know.
Well, you have to be in the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What do you feel is like the importance of, say, timing in comedy?
Timing, yes, you have to have a very astute sense, I suppose, of comic timing. I mean, for example, none of my jokes are written down. I just know that there's a whole lot of pinpoints in my head somewhere, and I need to run towards those as best I can throughout my sets, try and get back on track, because I'm always jumping around and things like that. But, yeah, timing is very important.
Well, what is it that makes timing so important? I've been wondering this lately, because you'll see certain times where we have these brief pauses, and then a comment that's even slightly quicker, and those sorts of things they turn into. I'm not sure what it is, if it's some sort of shock mechanism in the brain, whereby it's very similar to when you put a car in first gear and reverse at the same time. The car just goes.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. I think everything doesn't want to work at the same time. So you've got to use pauses. You've got to use I mean, for example, actually, I'll jump to this because my brain's working now. There's those old jokes, and if you've got a classic joke, you know how it's told. There's one way to tell it with these pauses here. If you don't put those pauses in, then the joke's fucked, you know?
I have actually noticed that, like, I don't know if you ever tell jokes to your siblings, but I've been trying to tell a joke to my sister, but she was about to start watching Game of Thrones, so I wanted to tell it as quickly as possible without... and. Wasn't funny in any way, shape, or form, because it was just kind of like rambled out. There wasn't any effect.
Yeah. Or if you're telling a story about a party, oh, you should have been there. It was so funny, and then it seems really stupid afterwards.
Because obviously you're not captured.
Yeah. What's that, sorry?
Well, the reason why it seems stupid after you say, oh, you should have been there, it was so funny, because obviously I wasn't there, bro.
That's right. So there's no point in telling a story if you can't capture the funny elements of it. And as a comedian, that's our job, of course, are capturing those elements.
Yeah.
And you weren't there. You weren't inside my brain, but this is what was happening.
So I found those stories are really great from personal experience. Like my mate Red, he's not a comedian or anything, but he can spin a yarn, right? And he was talking about how he went to Aussie and one of these drug dogs came up to him. And he says, oh, doggy, aren't you nice? The dog goes,
Yeah. You know, I've always loved going into, like, backwater pubs and talking to the guy with no teeth that's half blind and pissed as shit in the corner. They're my favourite sort of people to talk to. People that really look like they've lived, you know. The most interesting people. I'll just sort of go in. Amuse me. Come on, what do you got for me, huh?
G'day, how you going, you know? You put on the character if you have to, but yeah.
I'm always trying to absorb those people.
Is there a, for lack of a better term, a wanker element in the scene? I'm too good to hang out with people or be chilling on the level and that kind of thing. I've noticed it in my circuit of talk radio. There's a lot of people who are actually basically antisocial. But they have a gift for something that makes them have a public identity.
Yes, there you go. There are definitely two types of comedians. I suppose there are the guys that I would call a bit more wankery that are always out and about. You always see them, and they seem really arrogant, and they seem like they're above everybody. And there is a bunch of those, but then there are just the people. I suppose I'm a bit more like that as well. Like I need my me time, you know, because I also do tour guiding and stuff as well. You know, I'm always speaking, talking to the people, doing edgy tours, things like that. And so I just need time to switch off. You know, every day I just come and that's it. I'm finished talking, you know.
Yeah, and there's a point in the day where you just go, excuse me, please, I can't have this conversation right now. I'm having my me time.
Yeah, I've actually just said too many words today. That's it for now. I'm strung out. That's me. I'm finished now. I've turned off.
Well, it's kind of like what happens to cheerleaders in high school. Apparently, they get hoarse throats and they can't talk.
Which they're just not allowed to. Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, it's just like they're screaming chants and things like that during practice for hours, and they basically their voice just goes sometimes.
Yeah, or religious nutcases taking a vow of silence. Yeah.
I think there's a little bit of a column A and a little bit of column B going on.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Well, it's a reciprocal relationship, and this is the thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of being in the public eye, being on stage, across broadcast media, festivals and things of that nature. It gets to the point where you realise that you have less capacity to know the amount of people that can know of you.
And exactly right.
There is no possibility that you will know as many names of people who know your name. That sort of thing. Not talking about it in an arrogant sense of the word, but just thinking simple numbers.
Yes. Well, there is. There is only so many people you can know, and people go, "Do you remember me? I was at this show. I was at that show. I talked to you 10 years ago on the TV. All that sort of stuff." And you go, "Oh, did you just?" I get letters and stuff from like people that have come on my tours. I get a lot of fan mail and things from that element as well. People wanting to come to my shows, and they expect you to remember them. But I'm really great at talking to someone in person when I've got no idea who they are. No, it's a talent I've learnt.
Me too. I mean, like, if you can't remember their name, I go for the personal pronouns, you know, like a word that stays instead of a name, like bro, dude, or cuz, man.
That sort of thing, yeah. And then you'll throw in a compliment there, like, "Oh, they're nice shoes. They do you justice. Anyway, what can I do for you?" Which throws in a bit of positive reinforcement, and they feel better, and they don't care that you haven't said their name.
Often I profess ignorance and shame and say, I apologize. I have a terrible, appalling memory, and I've forgotten your name. Again.
And I've gone too far as well, where they start to talk about something serious and I really wish I'd asked them their name and I haven't done it. I get that too. And you've got to try and just work it into the conversation now, because they assume that you know their name, but you've got no idea. You're just struggling. You're thinking, "Oh, if they go to the toilet, maybe I could look through her handbag, find her wallet, find out her name. No, that's too invasive." Yeah, geez, you've got to think about that.
Well, I think it's all out of an effort to avoid embarrassment.
Avoid embarrassment, yeah. That's the thing, because we're frantically trying to run away from things that will embarrass us and not do them and do that and do. I just don't care myself, unless it's, like a professional thing like that I was talking about where I need to know the name. But of course, once the embarrassing thing happens, you remember it, you write a joke about it, you know?
Oh, yeah. I remember this time I was interviewing this lady from the gourmet soap kitchen, okay? Like, she makes these these artisan soaps and stuff like that for people with sensitive skin. Yeah. And I did this several-minute rant about the importance of eating good soup, you know, and how nutritious it is for you. It was so, so embarrassing.
Oh, my God.
I mean, like, on live radio, you know, like, thousands of listeners and stuff, and you're just sitting there and you're like, "Oh, my God." That was pretty much the run of it, eh? And then she went on to become a sponsor of mine because she liked it.
Oh, my God. That's a fantastic story.
Now, see, isn't it great how some of the best stories are the ones you can't make up?
Yeah, that's dead right. A lot of them are, and some of them are just in real just benign transactions in life that people don't think about. You know, like I was the dude in front of me at the ATM. What a weirdo he was. Da-da-da-da-da. Things you could just never make up. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's more like the creative process, and this is why I'm kind of like, I wonder whether evolution's really onto it enough. I mean, I think that the opposite is true, that devolution certainly happens. I believe we're in a vigorous phase of it at the moment.
Yeah, we're going backwards hard, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but at the end of the day, how can we put creativity in a spot and just go, okay, that's your limited space right there. don't frick anything. I mean, you know, we treat creativity now like a dangerous child or something of that nature that we want to keep safe. You know, stay within these bounds. Don't question that authority or these people who are telling you how to paint that picture. No. Don't go out on your own. Don't do your own thing. You've got to have some kind of a backup.
But apart from that, be creative.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right, especially in New Zealand. We're still not as open to creativity in New Zealand because we're an island literally at the bottom of the world, you know. Like we don't have that really intense pressure to keep moving and keep being open to things as much as we should.
Which is ironic because we're an incredibly well-travelled people, and I don't know about you, but any New Zealand band or comedian, artist, designers, and virtually any creative field that I've seen are virtually top of their game in terms of world class.
That's right. That's right. And then, you know, like you'll do a show in a city and for some reason there'll be, you know, you'll get a really tiny audience. And you'll sit there and you'll try and figure out where did we go wrong? What else was on tonight? Okay, this, this, and this. Is it because this? Is it because that? Sometimes there's no reason. Sometimes there is no reason why. It looked like it was going to rain this afternoon, and that turns out to be the reason. And whereas you go to, I think, a different country there, they're asking for comedy. They're begging for it. They're not begging enough in New Zealand. They need to want it. They need to show us they want it a bit more. Some of the big comedians I noticed after the comedy festival this year were saying, hey, remember that we're funny all weeks of the year, not just the few weeks of Comedy Fest, you know? And I thought that was a good message.
Well, I think it really is because at the end of the day, you have to have your laughs daily, you know? Yep. I mean, apparently a child laughs several hundred times a day. I saw in one of the Comedy Fest ads, and that astounds me.
Yeah, exactly. Where do they find time to laugh? When are they serious, you know? Yeah, exactly. But no, that's good, though. How great is that? And how happy are those children that laugh all the time?
Freaking happy as Larry's.
Happy, yeah.
So cackling makes you actually happier just in general. It's not like You're depressed, therefore you can't laugh. I can laugh my ass off when I'm feeling rubbish.
Yeah. See, that's the, and of course that's the best time. Sometimes in life you know that you need to laugh. Think, oh fuck, oh I better laugh at something. Oh, I really could do with a laugh. If I laugh, everything will be better. You know, because it is a remedy. It literally is.
Well, have you looked into this kind of thing in terms of the scientific research? I'm not sure if you have. I certainly
Bit. I've done some classes on laughing therapy because I went to drama school and I did all that sort of stuff and film school and then all these institutions and learned a whole bunch of stuff and then performed. And based on this, I think there really is a solution, which is just group laughing. Group laughing makes people so much better. John Cleese, he toured this. He did a tour of Africa and Europe and places like that with laughing therapy. There's pictures of him online in African villages, just laughing with everybody. And they're all just having the best time. They don't know why they're laughing. They're just doing it. And people have the next few days so fantastic for them. And that's why. That's the, because they took 10 minutes just to start laughing randomly at nothing. And you're not buying pills. You're not taking drugs, filling your system with chemicals. You're just fucking laughing.
Well, at the end of the day, if it's that powerful and that much of an antidepressant, wouldn't the drug companies try and shut comedy down?
Oh, God, that would be so. See, now, and one of my earlier shows this year, I did a piece on drugs. I was talking about pills and I was talking about this new Viagra drug and things, and I was laying into them. Fortunately, we had one of the comedy shows filmed for a TV episode earlier this year. And I just chose not to. I said, I won't do the drugs tonight, because I always try and have a theme for my rant for 20 minutes, for 30 minutes, for whatever, during a show. And, if I had done that on national television, I wonder what would have happened there. But, yeah, I suppose the drug companies are against comedy.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I haven't seen a whole lot of these drug company pushes out there with big beaming smiles on their face in the congressional subcommittee hearings and stuff like that, you know?
No. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because, you know, I was talking about the two people that advertise all the drugs from New Life Pharmacies, that do all the television advertisements. Now, we probably think that they're pharmaceutical reps, that they're scientists or something. But I worked out that their title is something like Corporate Pharmaceutical New Drug Public Interface People. It just means...
public relations.
Yeah. PR people, they've got nothing to do with it, you know? And if we could talk about that forever. We could talk about how terrible drugs are and what they're doing to our society, but far out. Just have a laugh. Have a bloody laugh.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a hell of a lot easier to pop onto YouTube and watch a video of a comedian and have yourself a laugh than it is to pop down to your local doctor, get a prescription with a pill that has about 200 side effects, including death, suicide, murder-suicide, yes, liver failure, kidney failure, and scratchy skin.
Scratchy skin, brain hemorrhaging and rashing. Yeah. You know, all those little words that we never read because we're just keen on a quick fix, you
so
know?
So are there any negative side effects to not taking stuff seriously?
Oh, sure there are, you know. I mean, I can't tell you how many times important people to me have said, Wyeth, come on, take it more seriously. But that's just the nature of being a comedian. Like, I do have a very serious side, but sometimes I don't bring it out when I should.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, it's all a matter of timing.
It is a matter of timing, my friend.
In terms of getting this show on the road, we're coming to the end of the segment now, Wyeth. I very much thank you for your contributions to the show. I've actually been having a few chuckles back here. If you have a website or some way of shamelessly self-promoting yourself, go for your life, because the show is very much like a bathtub, works not too well without a plug.
Absolutely. Comic Addiction on Facebook is our group. We're doing a show at Purple Rain in Dunedin on the 7th. We're doing a show in Invercargill on the 9th of August at 33 Live. And we're doing another show in Wanaka, yet to be decided.
Oh, that's going to be very nice. And we still have like another minute or so here. And lastly, can you tell me, what's one of the funniest things you've ever seen? I mean, in terms of your favourite comedians, one of the greatest jokes you've ever heard?
One of the greatest jokes I've ever heard. My favourite comedian is probably Frankie Boyle. His outlook on life is fantastic, you know, talking about Scottish people. Look, Scottish people need to relax more, which is why when we eat our shortbread, we always have some heroin with it. Just to relax a bit more and ease into the dull, depressing life in the drizzle of Scotland. He's one of my favourites.
Oh, that's gold. Oh, man. Well, it's been fun, Wyeth. I thank you very much for your time. And I also just wanted to give a wee plug for a few of our sponsors before we cut off to break, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, check out the Gourmet Soap Kitchen from Wagga Wagga on there on thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Volcania Coffee International, that's going to be starting up very soon. It's the very first world coffee company to ever be started specifically for the purpose of funding the production of alternative media like the Vinnie Eastwood Show. So there's a new business model for you. Check them out on Facebook there, Volcania International. Also, I wanted to give a special mention to the Blue Shield EMF protection devices. Mate, I unplugged mine the other day. I got sick in like 30 minutes. And after I got sick, now I'm talking about like a bit of a headache here, then came the rage. Oh, yeah. apparently all this EMF bouncing radiation wireless and crap and stuff is like emanating everywhere. But if you got like one signal, and it works the same with tuning forks that's stronger than the other signals, then all the tuning forks tune in, i.e. the cells that are interpreting the signals tune into the strongest one in the room, which is the blue shield, which is a non-radiation signal. Same one like a 7 hertz frequency or whatever it is of the Earth, the natural one, cancels out all the rest. Reduces your stress. Freaking amazing stuff. They even put it on cows, gave them 10% more milk production in the Waikato. I found that bloody amazing myself. Wyeth Chalmers, my very special guest, thank you very much, and we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Present is gone. Fantasy is a part of reality, and we take the brakes off. We're thinking clearly, yet not thinking at all. And this feels right. We stop trying to control things. Warm rush of chemicals through us. We're fluctuating. Is this brain damage? We forget all the pain and the hurt in life. We want to go somewhere else. We're not threatened by people anymore. All our insecurities have evaporated. We're in the clouds now. We're wide open. We're spacemen, orbiting the Earth. Yeah, the world looks beautiful from here, man. We're nympholeptics, desiring for the unobtainable. We risk sanity for moments of temporary enlightenment. So many ideas, so little memory. The last thought killed by anticipation of the next. We embrace an overwhelming feeling of love. We flow in unison. We're together. I wish this was real. We want a universal level of togetherness where we're comfortable with everyone. We're in rhythm, part of a movement to escape. We wave goodbye. Ultimately, we just want to be happy. Yeah.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. There's been a wonderful episode so far. We've had so far three comedians, and now we're going to round off the episode with our final. His name is Ants Heath. Ants, welcome to the program.
Hey, mate, how's it going?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Not bad.
Would you be able to enlighten me as to just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
A little bit about myself. I do a bit of stand-up comedy these days. I'm trained in street theatre and physical and experimental theatre forms. I've worked as an improviser for years. I'm also the nominated representative for the Rimitaka Award for the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party. Very publicly open about the fact that I enjoy cannabis for recreational purposes and that I think that the law against it is bullshit. Yeah,
I'd probably say so. The drug law comes down to this. Do you know somebody who's ever used cannabis? Yes. Do you think that they should be in jail right now because of it? No. Time to change the fucking law, mate.
Yep, pretty much, man. But as long as there's money to be made by putting people in jail, we'll have to keep fighting on.
Oh, well, thank God for private prisons, eh?
Yeah, it seems like a great idea.
I mean, what would we do without them?
Not be
incarcerated, still be around your family.
Free, I don't know, not be afraid of police officers? Who knows?
It's just too complicated. I just prefer slavery.
Yeah, well, you know, I work in a call centre, man. It's pretty much the same thing.
That's kind of how I did it as well. Doing the call centre thing. Are you doing telesales or are you doing inbound?
I'm inbound nowadays. Yeah, no, I don't do the outbound anymore. For those of you listening who still struggle with that, good on yous, but you're welcome to it. Yeah.
There's more money, but there's also a hell of a lot more emotional stress in the job.
Oh, so much more stress. So much more.
Now, in terms of the New Zealand comedy scene, what kind of area do you like to focus on? I mean, because I sent out this message asking for New Zealand comedians that were somewhat anti-establishment and whatnot, and your name came up. I'm wondering what led you to all of this.
That was, I believe there was Alistair Gregory who sort of tipped you off about me. He's the Wellington regional manager for the ALCP. So he's been to my, I did a show during the festival called Token White Guy, which was pretty much a whole lot of stories about my youth. And rather than stories about getting arrested, most of mine were stories in which I probably should have. But I'm fortunate in that I'm white and I have an education, so I don't get arrested by police for minor infractions, unlike other people who are not as lucky.
Mm. And are you over 25?
Yeah, I'm 37, mate.
Well, see, that's often... I was doing a oh, what was I? I was in Auckland Uni doing an essay about cannabis for a project, and yep. I decided I'd ask a cop, you know, what do you look for when you look for cannabis users? And he says, groups of males under 25.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, it's literally an age thing.
yeah, pretty much is, you know. Oh, a lot of it has to do with your approach with the police as well. I mean, I've been questioned by them out the back of a bar where, you know, I offered a mate a joint and then Chinese whispers happened and I found myself out the back of a bar with 12 people looking to me to blow them out. And so I had a couple of joints on me and I proceeded to pass them around the circle, and then the cop car sort of cruised by nice and slow down the driveway. Well, actually it was a mufti, and he went by and everyone went, oh yeah, you know, that wasn't a cop. And then of course you heard them hit reverse and they came through. And at the time, I was probably in my 20s, and I was dressed like a freak. I'd just finished all my training and stuff, so I was wearing giant top hats and all sorts of, odd stuff. And they came up and asked me, and a friend of mine was shocked that when the police officer said to me, what are you doing? I said, oh, we were just smoking a joint. And a friend of mine said, well, yeah, that's like the worst thing you could possibly say. And I pointed out to him, I said, sometimes the police ask you questions because they want to know the answer of the question. And then other times they're just deciding whether they want to be a prick or not. And I was smoking that joint openly as he walked towards me, and he saw me flick it away, and I reeked of weed. So there was really no point arguing that one, you know. And because I was up front and said, oh, look, I was just smoking some weed, they thought that because there was a big group of straight-dressed people standing around a freak that I was obviously selling some kind of pills. And once I said, look, no, I'm just having a joint, they said, oh, well, just go back inside and have a nice night.
Matey potatey. Because they probably would have had to arrest everybody at the party for smoking a joint if they arrested you.
The paperwork involved, what a bloody hassle, you know. So as it was, they only singled out me and another guy to be searched anyway and questioned. And, because I'd been up front with them, I mean, most police officers are aware of the hypocrisy of the situation that they're under. And they are human beings who, you know, they're not too rushed. The best thing about that whole thing was that at the time I was couch surfing, so I actually got to tell the police legitimately that I lived at no fixed abode, which was quite a buzz for myself.
I think that what it comes down to, ultimately, when we're talking about cannabis, is there's we've already won the debate. Okay, long ago, all right?
And, oh, yeah.
You know, it's over. And the fact that it's still freaking illegal just baffles the mind and makes me, I don't know, let's just say it is a certitude that there's huge quantities of lies and scumbaggery going on in order to keep this law in place. And anybody who tries to keep it in place the way it is a scumbag too.
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty good deal. I mean, I'd definitely trust the people that I buy marijuana off before I'd trust people who are trying to keep it illegal. So just on the worthiness of the people that I deal with.
Yeah. I came up with a joke yesterday. I was driving over to my mate's place and I said, why do fish make really good, fair dealers? Because they've got scales.
There must be a lot of fish in the small in-town city that I lived in, mate. It's a very busy place.
I just
think that it's a bit rough the way that some people are treated on it and others, you know, and it is obviously hypocritical and they have no argument against it, you know, and you just end up in that same cycle with people where, you know, drugs, you know, they tell you that drugs are bad and you ask them why and they tell you because the government says that it's illegal and, you say, well, you know, why is it illegal? And they say, well, because they're bad. And you're like, well, why are they bad? Because they're illegal. And they just sort of circle along like that until they run out of steam, really.
Yeah, it's quite easy circular reasoning, because it's circular reasoning.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's, the best thing about circular reasoning is that you don't have to think.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't like to. So in questioning the established, the status quo, as it were, is not everybody's thing, as it were.
Do you feel that people are getting dumber, like just in general?
I feel that I myself am getting dumber for every 5 minutes that I spend watching something stupid on YouTube. So I guess as a society, yes. I mean, the education standards, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit old now and I'm looking back on things differently, but I think that there used to be a lot more education and respect going on than there is these days. So, and, you know.
Have you got, like, an example of that? I mean, because I'm just thinking about it now. There's not a whole lot of difference between when I was born and when I am now today, between how kids treated me, and it's just with zero respect, because I was born in 1984, and all of a sudden, yeah, respecting your elders didn't count anymore.
Yeah, I guess so. That's pretty much how it seems to be. I mean, I regularly hear teenagers saying things in public that I, you know, that wouldn't have occurred to me to have ever said to somebody, just purely because I guess it comes down to the individual circumstances and the upbringing that you personally have, but I was brought up to believe in respecting other people and, you know, being polite and things like that, you know, and P's and Q's, they don't seem like much until you remove them from society, at which point everyone just seems a whole lot more aggressive and sort of more about themselves rather than other people. I mean, we've really lost that community feeling that we used to have, you know. Back in the early 80s, I read an article the other day about the fact that, you know, when I was a kid, if you misbehaved in the store and your parents weren't there, the store owner told you, oi, buck your ideas up or you're out, you know, and that was how it was, you know. Now, if he tries and does that now with a teenager, the teenager's likely to turn around and point out, well, actually, under the Bill of Rights, and I have rights as a human being, and you can't tell me what to do, and, you know, you're not physically allowed to remove me from your store, and if you call the police, they're not going to come, and there's really no one for you to call. My parents don't care either, so, you know, get fucked.
Or they'll just simply use the last two words in and of itself.
Well, even when they just run it down to that, you know, it's unnecessary. So, you know, there just seemed to be a lot more focus on getting on together as people.
Yeah. Well, on my sticker, I've got a bumper sticker that says, marijuana, can't we all just get a bong?
Yeah, exactly. You know, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? So, I mean, the big difference between straight people and people who smoke pot is that people who smoke pot don't care that straight people exist.
I would think it's a very similar story to back in the day. The CIA conducted a whole bunch of mind control on experiments on people under MKUltra, which got exposed a while ago, and they did tests on people's brains with all sorts of different drugs, and the one that they stopped using for mind control was marijuana, because they found that the patients became resistant to mind control techniques if they smoked it.
Oh, God, you can't have that. Oh, my God, it's opening their minds and they're thinking for themselves. Fuck, you better get rid of that shit, man, and ban it everywhere while you're at it. You know, you can't have people thinking that they've got ideas.
Yeah. Well, it's dangerous.
Non-conformity can't be had.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not a control freak. And it just seems that somebody who's complete... Well, like... You have a look at the situation, and you say why they made it illegal, because, you know, they want to mind control you, they don't want you to be free, they don't want you to think for yourself, blah, 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 blah. And they go, oh, but why would somebody who's a criminal, ruthless, sociopathic scumbag with more money than God try to control things like that? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Well, maybe if you're trying to think like a ruthless, criminal, sociopathic scumbag for 2 seconds, it might make sense to you.
Yeah. It's called big bank accounts, and lots of them love it.
There's the other element as well, of course, the medical treatment of patients. And do you know anybody who's got medical problems who treats them with cannabis? I do, you know.
Yep, I do.
Yeah. And for goodness sake, I've seen what these guys are like. with and without the weed. Without the weed, it is a life of pain, suffering, and anguish, and torment. With the weed, it is comfortable and livable.
Yeah, but the problem is, Vinny, that as you well know, Big Pharma doesn't make any money if you just plant yourself a plant in the backyard and smoke that and get healthy. I mean, what's that going to do to the bottom line of the Lilly Corporation? You just can't have that kind of activity going on. I mean, it's where the bushes get most of their money from. They make more money from pharmaceuticals than they ever did out of oil, you know, because they convinced an entire country that they needed to be on antidepressants and hard pills, for fuck's sake. I mean, the fact, if you want to take away, like, you know, there are people who say, well, yeah, you shouldn't smoke pot, you're just a stupid stoner, whatever, you know. If they've got a problem with me smoking it recreational, that's one thing. But when you're actually refusing to give people good, healthy, safe, cheap medication that can change their lives for the better in such a massive way, and your argument to it is, well, we can't do it because there's this side effect, you see, and you'll end up stoned, and unfortunately that means that you'll be chatty and you'll enjoy life more and you'll eat. And, you know, so obviously we can't possibly give you that. Now, we have this pill. It's about $100. It doesn't really work as well, and you'll need the other 45 pills that go with it because of the massive life-threatening risk of side effects from that first pill. But, you know, that's the way that we're going to do it, because we can't let people just grow dope, because, you know, you never know how strong it is. You know, and that to me is the most disgusting thing that the government's ever done on the entire scale. I mean, I would actually quite gladly give up my ability to smoke it recreationally if they could only allow complete and open access to everybody who needs it for medical use.
Well, they're talking about it in the United States now, that they're going to have what they call cannabis welfare. So people who can't afford a ganja will actually be given it if they've got medical problems and things of that nature for free by certain dispensaries. Or at least that's what they're talking about now. We're talking about a...
Brilliant idea.
Sorry, what was it? Yeah, it's a good idea, isn't it? And the other element here that I find particularly interesting about the drug law is not only the fact that it's used as a discrimination for, like, young people, not only the fact that it's used as, I don't know, more or less keeping the cookies away from the children in terms of the medical patients, you know, ensuring that they don't live a happy life. But I think it's a war on consciousness. Simply that it turns us against each other. All these people, particularly my elders sometimes, who have not used cannabis before, every time I tell them I'm going through a hard time, emotional issues or something like that, like everybody does, guess what the first thing they say is the cause of them all?
Oh, you've got to get off that weed there, Vinny. That's your problem. Get off that weed and you'll be fine, mate. There's your problem right there. Get off the weed.
Yeah.
Is that about it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've been through the same argument. Luckily, I have a really enlightened doctor who understands and doesn't have any problems with it. And I've had a few enlightened doctors over the years, you know, but you've got to be honest with doctors about drug use, because, you know, you never know when it's going to actually be pertinent. So, you know, but I find that the whole divide and conquer aspect is definitely what they're into, you know? And, I mean, we've got these buffoons in government at the moment really trying to crank it about how, you know, still towing the line that, you know, marijuana's illegal because it's not safe for you. And yet we've just gone through the most ridiculous experiment. Well, maybe I'll call it an experiment. It was more of a profit-making drive, really, to have this synthetic crap. You know, so how did New Zealand end up in a position where we are now years behind America with the freeing up of cannabis regulation? I mean, that's just, to me, that blows my mind.
Even more so than AK-47, I'll wager.
Well, AK-47 is pretty good if you get it grown in the right conditions.
Yeah, kind of like shrooms. When we talk about comedy, shifting gears a little bit here, I think that maybe you'll agree with the statement, maybe you won't. I believe that comedy is the most effective medium for giving people information that they're not prepared to listen to.
Yeah, I'd say it works well for that. It depends on the comedian and what their buzz is, and I don't like to get into the conversation of, well, as a comedian, you should be saying this, you know, or you should be saying that. I think to me, the litmus test is quite simple. I get up on a stage and I say things, and if the room full of people laugh, then generally I consider that to be a joke, and we go with that, you know. Quite often, I do sort of bring up things that, you know, the hypocrisy of things, or the, you know, just the general, I guess, I get annoyed with the general stupidity around us a lot, and so I do talk about that quite a bit and point out situations that drive me insane that I find quite a lot of people do go through with me as well. So you get that sort of common ground, and I think for all comedy, that's really what you're after, is to find a common ground and get people to understand you and know you as a mate and understand that, hey, if he says something highly offensive, it's probably just a joke. You know, let's move on from that. But you can, there's definitely the power there to make people face things that they don't really like to face. And, you know, and I do enjoy when I do a particularly offensive piece. I love that moment after the laugh. So the audience will laugh, and then there's a silence for a couple of seconds, and I know that the entire room is sitting there thinking, did I just laugh at that? You know, so, and that for me is always fun. I like to confront people with that kind of material.
Is that because when something's funny, it's usually because it's true? I mean, people say that the truth hurts, and I'm starting to believe the opposite, that the truth is frickin' hilarious.
I think it cuts both ways, really. I mean, there's some stuff that's completely made up that people find hilarious, but when I do face them with the truth, they sort of get a giggle out of that as well. I mean, it's... Yeah, it can be either way, and it really does depend on the kind of room that you've got. So, you know, that's one thing that has to be taken into account. Sometimes you'll have a very serious room who, you know, will freak out if you make the slightest racial slur, and then sometimes you'll have a room who are fine with jokes about paedophilia, and you've just sort of got to work it out. And occasionally I have gotten it wrong, but, you know, for the most part, I try to aim where they want me to go.
Well, that reminds me, I was at the Classic Comedy Bar one time filming my sister doing her her gig, and one of the guys who came out on stage had, like, the worst set you could ever conceive of in your life, as in the highlight of it was questioning whether or not he's a pedophile on stage, and it was just not funny, and it made everybody really uncomfortable. And then then he went off stage, and I think he took like an extra 5-10 minutes on his set that he was supposed to. He's just sitting there waffling, rambling, didn't realise that his set was over. And all of the comedians there that night were reasonably good. Some were real, real funny, and these were all newbies, right? And the guy who was sort of, you know, the professional comedian there who's like introducing everybody or whatever, he comes out on stage and he goes... something along the lines of, like, all these people here are like my children, and somebody shouts out from the crowd, "You've had at least one abortion," and the whole crowd like uproared with like huge applause and stuff like that, and it was so ironic that the head comedian was like, you know, I've never actually heard people laugh that loud at an abortion joke.
Yep, it's you know, it's all about timing and place, you know, and you've just got to. Well, I say there are some that believe that there are hard and fast rules. I'm just not one of those people.
Now, my question to you is, can you even teach somebody how to be humorous, or is it just a natural thing that you work out on your own? You work out your own timing, you watch other comedians. It's not like a mentoring thing.
I think it's one of those things. I think that if you really, really want it, if you wake up every day and you just get... fuck it, I want to be a comedian, then with enough work you can get there. And I think that there are some people working who are possibly, you know, they're just really hard workers. I guess it's, you know, I'm from the theatre industry originally, and it's just like the theatre industry, is that you'll have some people who, you'll have different ranges of talent and then different amounts of work, and if you're really talented, then you don't necessarily have to work so hard and you just sort of fly through it. If it's not so natural to you, then you can work on it. There's tons of classes. I mean, God, the internet gives you enough information now, but you can learn how to structure jokes and things like that and have very well-scripted work. So, yeah, I think it's pretty open opportunities, really. It just depends on who you are and what kind of comedy you want to do. But the number one thing is you have to really want to do it because, you know, it's bloody hard work and you've got to die on stage a few times, which is never nice.
Yeah, I would say so. Now, last question before we have to wrap up the show here is, have there ever been any wonderful experiences or maybe bad experiences that you'd like to recount? Something that happened that maybe was a little off topic or off script that was just like so freaking funny that you've remembered it up until now?
Oh, at a gig?
Yeah.
It'd be a really drunk chick who showed up for a gig that I was emceeing a few years ago during the comedy festival. And she came in, and you know, she was quite rowdy with her mates, and it was a rookie lineup. And there's nothing that'll scare a group of rookies more than hearing some drunk cow just going off at everybody, you know. So she'd sort of started to kick up a wee bit during my opening set, and I'd laid it down pretty quickly to her. I chatted to her a bit. She was wearing a white tracksuit and drunk, so I called her Hut Bride, that kind of thing, you know. And just sort of explained to her that, look, you know, I'm the MC and I've got a bit of experience, and if you want to throw stuff at me, that's all right, because I'm pretty lazy and I don't write material anyway, so it'll just fill my time. But if you could just leave the other acts alone, that'd be great, because they're rookies, they've got their sets all lined up and you'll just throw them and everyone will have a bad night. And, of course, she went on to lambast and give absolute, you know, terrors to everybody to the first act who got up, which had the rest of the rookies sweating bullets. And I pointed out those, you know, the next one when I was about to go on, I said, oh, no, she's going to ruin the whole night. And I said, no, she won't ruin the whole night. And she says, oh, what do you mean? I said, I'll watch. So, yeah, I got out for my second bit and said, oh, you know, are you having a good night? And she went, no, and I knew because she'd been arguing with her mates. And she said, no, and I said, oh, I know what happened. Did your whole night go sort of pear-shaped? And she's like, yeah. And I said, oh, did you have a great night planned? And just everything turned to poo. And she's like, yeah. And I said, yeah, well, that's great. That happened to me as well. I mean, what happened in your case? Did you have some drunk bitch show up at your gig and not learn to shut the fuck up? And, that was probably, for me, that would be one of my favourite moments on stage.
Yeah.
The heckler kill. I had to be nasty, but yeah, when I get to be nasty with them, it is quite enjoyable.
Well, I found the nasty heckler slapdowns to be some of the best. There was one gig I was at where there was a really overweight Australian comedian, amateur, and somebody shouts out in the crowd, "Why are you so fat?" And he says to him, "Because every time I fuck your mother, she gives me a jelly bean."
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I always do the conversation with them first and let them know that, you know, no, that's not really on and I'd rather that you just, you know, quietly enjoyed the show. But there comes a point, especially if they're really drunk, where you just have to be brutal because I need it to be over and done with, you know. It has to be made quite clear, no matter how drunk they are, that this is not going to continue and they're not going to ruin the entire night for everybody. And, you know, I've been on the receiving end of it myself as the drunk heckler guy. So, you know, I do have compassion for them where they're coming from, but everyone else has paid for their tickets and expects to enjoy their night as well.
Wonderful New Zealand comedian Ants Heath, ladies and gentlemen. Ants, where can people find more of your material and find out when your next gigs are and whatnot?
Oh, they can check me out on, I'm on Facebook, like most people are, so if you check out the Book of Face, Ants Heath, Token White Guy, you'll find that, and I put updates there for all of my future and upcoming gigs.
Right, thank you very much for your time today, mate, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Bear in mind, this is a predominantly listener-supported broadcast, so if you want to keep these broadcasts going and giving people a platform to speak about things that, well, basically the mainstream media will never give you 25 minutes of frickin' airtime to say whatever you want, so if you want that to continue, please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, as in go ahead. Make my news. And go ahead and make a donation. And start up those automatic payments as well. $5 a month, $10 a month. We have certain listeners who do $100 or $50 a month and things of that nature. All of it is simply just to, you know, pay the expenses of life so that I can continue to expose scumbaggery and help the innocent. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.